Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the African state's position on the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Christopher Isike. Professor Isike is a professor of African politics and international relations at the Department of Political Sciences at the University of Pretoria, South Africa. He's also the director of the African Center for the Study of the United States, also at the University of Pretoria. He's also currently the president of African Association of Political Sciences, among other appointments. Christopher, I'm happy to have you join me today, and I definitely look forward to our conversation.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for having me on your show.
Brilliant. Let me begin by saying, does Africa as a collective, does Africa have a position on the Israel-Hamas war? If yes, what is it?
Well, Africa does not currently have a position. Historically, the continent has always had a kind of unified position because of our experience of colonialism and oppression, which linked in many ways to the kind of colonialism and oppression, and even if you like, apartheid that the Palestinians started suffering from 1948 when they became dominated by the State of Israel. On that score, a lot of African countries affiliated or understood and connected with the Palestinian struggle for liberation from Israel. And so that was generally the position until, in 1975, and then after the Oslo agreement in 1993, we started seeing more African countries, looking at their specific interests, in relating to Israel. And that kind of started the divide. But the one issue that has really brought the divide sharply now is the current conflict, the current Israeli war in Gaza, which has actually polarized the continent even more since 7 October 2023.
Interesting. So if historically Africans, we know the continent is one that was has experienced them colonialism and occupation and that, and by that virtue they've always, like you mentioned, historically supported Palestine. But we've seen in this particular, since October 7, the attack of Hamas against Israel and then the retaliatory attack from Israel, we've seen a division, which you've said goes back to the Oslo Declaration in 1993, but we've seen a very sharp stance from different African states. So we've seen where pro-Israel countries like Kenya, countries like Rwanda, And we've seen those that are anti-Israel, pro-Palestine, if you want to call it, like South Africa and the rest, Chad. And then we've seen those that are being neutral, I think Nigeria also. So how can you explain these mixed positions? What is behind these ones? What is behind each of these positions that these countries have taken?
Well, like I said, it's more of the individual interest, the national interest of different countries looking at their issues around economics, looking at issues around security, and even if you like, cultural and kinship connections between some of these countries like Ethiopia and Israel. So. Broadly, like I said earlier on, the solidarity that we have in the continent with Palestine is based on Palestine's own solidarity with Africa, especially during the struggle for freedom and liberation in Africa. So you find out that Palestinians have always seen their struggle for liberation in the context of the struggle for, countries in Africa against, Western imperialism and colonialism. So based on that, you find that the African Union, even from its inception, has taken positions on Palestine that are fundamentally, supportive of its independence and sovereignty. Just to ensure, and of course, I'll be giving our kind of approach to our foreign policy in Africa. I'm talking generally now because different states also have different approaches. But broadly, Africa takes a peaceful approach to resolving conflict in the international system. And based on that, the African Union has always supported, the two-state solution. Okay, as a way of resolving this, but like you said, not all members of the African Union have the same opinion, and each of them take a position, based on what they perceive to be their national interests. You've mentioned Ghana, Kenya, Rwanda. As some of the countries that support Israel and even condemn Hamas in this specific conflict. But if you begin to take a look at each of those countries, you'll find that they have different kinds of connections, mainly economic connections with Israel, that has grown its footprint on the continent, in the last, 10 years or so. So out of the 55 countries in Africa, for example, that make up the African Union, over 40, I think 46, if I remember correctly, have established all kinds of diplomatic, economic, and development ties with Israel, right? So these are the drivers of the kind of divisions you see. While some have liberalized, especially when you look at how Egypt normalized relations with Israel in the 70s, and then in 2017, we also saw normalization of relations with Israel by the Gulf state. The thinking then started within the continent that if the Arab countries are normalizing relations with Israel, why should Africa begin to be any different in terms of how it takes care of its interests? So since 2017, you've seen more countries open all kinds of relations with Israel. However, these support, if you like, those that support Israel, there is also a dichotomy between the kind of support that the governments of these countries give and what citizens of their countries express on the ground for Israel. You find out that you find opposition. So you mentioned Nigeria, for instance, that is kind of neutral, scored for a two-state solution. But you find that in the northern part of the country, there is a serious support with even protestations, I think around November in 2023, supporting the Palestinian cause. So you find those kinds of disconnects between citizens, what governments of these countries, like even Kenya, say, and what their citizens do in terms of protests. Another country that comes to mind in terms of supporting Israel would be Morocco, you know. And then if you look at their citizens, you will see a disconnection between what government of Morocco is doing in terms of official state policy towards Israel and what citizens have done. For example, you find that among the countries where we've had protests, pro-Palestinian protests, for example, Morocco has the highest number globally, okay? But that is on the, with the people on the ground. Quite different from what the government of Morocco is doing in terms of, you know, kind of past tacit support for the Israeli case against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
A very interesting thing you mentioned, and I've always been in my own kind of like study of position, like every state has a strategic interest, and sometimes we like to conceal or come under the guise of, you know, humanitarian interventions or that, but there's only states, and I've always maintained that states should, there's nothing wrong with having interest and pretending that interest, but if we see how we can strike a balance. So in my own study, or when I talk to my students, I always say, how do we get that balance? So I will make a reference before I ask the question to the kind of moral dilemma that the Western world faces, the United States, who the United Kingdom, in terms of the ongoing war, in terms of, okay, do we continue to support our Israel ally in the face of, you know, this extensive or, you know, suffering or killing of innocents? You know, it's hard to want to maintain that and they face that moral dilemma. So in Africa, for instance, what you've just mentioned, so while we see where this states are driven by strategies, and you see that disconnect between the people, as like you mentioned. But in South Africa, I think South Africa provides a model, and I want you to expand on that. So South Africa, I think, has the highest trade, whatever, with Israel. I think I was looking in 2021, you know, the 2/3 of the trade, this thing was with South Africa, and, you know, Nigeria was following second behind. But yet, South Africa maintains a very hard stance against, you know, Israel's position. How is that South Africa able to get away with that? How are they able to do that? Does that provide a sort of a model for other states?
Yeah, well, it does in many ways, but it does not come without repercussions for South Africa. Like you said, South Africa has the highest trade volumes in Africa with Israel. But yet it has come out as one of the fiercest critics of the Israeli position and its war in Gaza. As we speak, and I'm sure like you know, South Africa does not have an ambassador in Tel Aviv. The Israeli ambassador to South Africa has also been recalled. So this crisis have also gone beyond economics to politics as well, and you know, of course, it's not common knowledge that South Africa took Israel to the ICC and won majority of its prayers against Israel, which it has continued to press for, but this has not come without cost, like I said. So no flights between both countries, which is a big hit for the economy of both countries, South Africa likewise. You know, the trade relations is frozen for now, which also affects South Africa in many ways. But the government of South Africa is taking a principled stance based on its friendship ties with the Palestinians, which have also been, which is actually rooted in, like I said earlier on, the idea that the Palestinians have about intersecting their fight for freedom with the fight for freedom in Africa, and this was well echoed by South Africa's first democratic president, the late Nelson Mandela, who said that our freedom will be incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinian people, and so that is the principle on which South Africa has maintained its support, you know, for Palestine. And if you like, I can tell you now that the support that South Africa has for Palestine is the most consistent foreign policy position that South Africa has shown in all its foreign policy engagements and positions since 1994. And so it was a question of principles over economics, principles over politics, and I think that they stand by it. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, for example, has said that in response to Israel, foreclosing and ending economic relations with South Africa, South Africa would diversify, those markets to other areas in the East and possibly also in the West, who would be interested in taking up some of these opportunities for trade between both countries. So it is a matter of principle for South Africa, and I think that with the way that the world is beginning to respond, and of course with the support that majority of South Africans have given to the government. Because of this principled stance, it has not been that bad. So there's been economic losses, but there's been admiration, soft power, leverage that South Africa has yielded globally, and even the ruling party itself has actually also won the hearts of people who otherwise were going to be neutral, and may become an issue even in the 2024 elections in May in South Africa, which is the most significant elections that this country has had since 1994.
So if I stay on this other South Africa, so you've mentioned that the majority support the government's position, but we've also seen where the foreign minister Naledi Pandor has issued a warning against those that may be fighting for in Tel Aviv for the Jews against to maybe strip them of their citizenship or to be prosecuted. So is this significant enough? Are we having a significant number of South Africans on the side of the Israel to warrant such a threat or such declaration?
Well, like I said, the majority of the population support what the government is doing, and it's across the board, but politically you have political parties like the Democratic Alliance and Freedom Front Plus. These are white-dominated parties that support Israel. But interestingly, it also cuts across religion. You have the African Christian Democratic Party that supports Israel and so goes against the position of the government, and the African Democratic African Christian Democratic Party is a black dominated party. So those are some of the nuances that we will need to look at. But overall, if you take a look at the population in relation to the overall population, the number of these people is small. But not insignificant, given the political muscle that some of these people have in the country. And I'm sure that is what would have necessitated that kind of action from the foreign minister spoke about Dr. Naledi Pandor.
So if we look at some of the, you mentioned soft power and some of these approaches. So we've seen where shockingly, in the West, like I mentioned, the kind of like moral dilemma that they're in terms of like, but then again, if we come to Africa, I don't know where I read it, and where someone was talking about Africa's position in international relations in the communes and how Africa expresses its agency or leverage. And it, one of the ways that I think is one of the first prime minister in Israel in an autobiography admitted that, Israel needed Africa's help. In terms of like maybe in the United Nations, maybe having things like that. And I think there are other ways as well where the relationship can go both ways, where Israel needs Africa, Africa needs Israel. So how do you think? So I think let me say this statement that I think it was Netanyahu that said in 2007. He said Israel is coming back to Africa and Africa is coming back to Israel. What do you think that? Can you dissect that statement?
Well, he said that he was quite early in predicting this sudden, reignited interest in Africa, not just by Israel, but by all kinds of economic powers and all different regions of the world that have started courting Africa again, reminiscent of the Cold War era, where Africa was like a bride that was courted by two major world powers. So there has been that. And you can see this agency you mentioned expressed during the United Nations General Assembly vote in early 2022. Where Africa voted, in ways that were unexpected, but in ways that significantly affected the outcome. And that's when, it became clear that Africa was indeed has largest voting bloc in the United Nations General Assembly, and that Africa's votes mattered. That quickly led to a recalibration of the U.S. U.S. strategy towards Africa. There was one that was crafted in 21, and then bandied around the continent by the Secretary of State for the U.S., Antony Blinken. Yes, in late 21, it's in November, he started with, I think he went to Ghana, I remember Ivory Coast, and I think Nigeria was part of the countries he went to sell that policy. But after the war broke out in 22, the Russian war in Ukraine broke out in 22, and following how Africa voted in March at the UN General Assembly, there was a recalibration of that policy and brought the 2022 one, which started with viewing Africa as equal partners. Before then, the term equal had never been in the envisaged partnership between the US and Africa broadly. So you saw that, and I think that the world started recognizing that agency, that Africa could be swing voters in matters like this, could be swing decision makers, could either vote for or against, spoil the party if you like. And to that extent, of course, added to the fact that Africa, as its location is geostrategic, and also in terms, not just in terms of resources, but also in terms of the future of the world, in terms of our young population, right? Mm-hmm. And the potential that holds for the future of the world, not just for Africa alone, but the world. And so there's been this renewed interest. So what you have countries like Japan, countries like Australia, talk of Israel, all of them now having policy towards Africa. For me, the challenge is whether Africa is ready for this reignited interest, whether Africa is ready as a bride, whether Africa has an identity or knows its identity, whether it has one and knows it, and then is able to articulate what it wants from these entities by different countries, including even Turkey. So that is where I think the challenge is, the fact that we have not yet articulated a common African position or a template for dealing with the United States, for dealing with China, for dealing with Russia, for dealing with Israel, for dealing with Turkey, for dealing with Japan and the European Union. We do not have. Rather, you have EU-Africa policy, US-Africa policy, China-Africa policy, and all these policies towards Africa, which makes us a sitting duck. We're recipients of all these policies without any kind of understanding of why these people are coming. Maybe we do have an idea of why they are coming, but what they want from us and what we can get from that relationship, we have not yet articulated as a continent. And whether it serves our interest to allow ourselves to deal with them as small states vis-a-vis these countries, rather than articulating a common vision, a common position, around which the African Union or the African Union Commission can act on behalf of the continent. So that for me is the real challenge that we have about this particular renewed interest. And the one that Israel has towards the continent is not different from it.
Mm. Very, very interesting. Like we've seen, like you mentioned, maybe I might slightly, not necessarily disagree with you, but I agree with
you. I'm losing you. I'm not hearing you. Your network is fluctuating.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I don't hear you.
Saying during the Cold War, so we had Africa. I don't know if until now Africa's position is the non-alignment position. But what we've seen now was we're seeing some sort of attempt to have a collective, African collective, whether through the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, or you see the AU Agenda 2063, African solution for African solutions, all these kind of conversations. But I wanted to ask you, how far do this go far enough? I know there are still challenges, but is this in the right direction in crafting a unified collective? How would you assess those instruments or those kind of like policies that are in place that are in motion already?
Okay, so again, you were breaking. I didn't hear the first part of the question around the Cold War, but what I'm hearing you say is whether Africa is trending towards the right direction in terms of Agenda 2063, and other like the AFTA, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. And I think I will answer that directly and say yes, those are the right thinking, the right policies in the right direction. How those will be implemented, how they are being implemented. We will need to see a review of by the African peer review mechanism to see how each country is actually looking to implement some of the recommendations or some of the imperatives and mandates of the, for example, Africa Continental Free Trade Area. But overall, the question of a common position that will result to a policy on how to deal with big powers is still missing, okay? Otherwise, many of these countries will come to Africa, exploit the AFTA for their own benefits, and that will work against the purpose of the AFTA, which is meant to also actually ignite trade within the continent. Because if Africa is able to trade within itself, it may have more leverage to be able to contend with some of these powers that try to bully Africa into taking positions that are not that are inimical to its interest. So the power of the economy is important, and the after Africa Continental Free Trade Area Agreement provides us an opportunity to trade with ourselves, build our economies, build our capabilities, industrialize, if possible, create new markets within the continent that will create prosperity. Those are the envisaged objectives of the AFTA. But if we do not have a common position on how, for example, we'll allow other countries in the world to access those markets and how much they can exploit it, you'll find that it will be inimical to the objectives of the AFTA itself. So I think we need, the economic plan is good, but we need an overarching position specifically on how to deal with big powers and middle powers, if you like. And so we'll have those two positions and then itemize what big powers what we mean by big powers and what we mean by middle powers. So countries like Australia, for instance, can fall into the middle power categorization. Turkey, Brazil, India, all of these countries have interest in the continent, not because they love us, but because of the resources that we have, both human and material. and so seeking to exploit this. But if we don't have a plan, an overarching political plan on how to engage and deal with these people, it will not work out well for us in the long term. So and that's why I'm saying that the policies are there. It's one thing to craft the policies, but you need an action plan and a mechanism for actually implementing that. And I think that we lack that currently as we speak. And I'm not saying that we should necessarily have one position and become one voting block on every single issue. There is nothing stopping us from supporting a particular cause because it advances our economic interests, but also taking a principled political stance against it because it aligns with our foreign policy principle. And this is what South Africa is doing. If you look at how South Africa is engaging with the United States vis-a-vis Russia, you'll find that South Africa is able to straddle that relationship, relate with the U.S., but disagree with it on certain aspects of the conflict with Russia, relate with Russia, but it's able to tell Russia that on this one, we cannot support you like the president did trying to convince Vladimir Putin not to come to South Africa for the BRICS summit. So that dexterity, that savviness, we need to be able to have. The United States as a country can deal with any country in the world, whether you are a dictator or a democracy. They just outline what their interest is and deal with you accordingly. So if the US can do so, if different countries of the world can do so, why can't Africa do the same? And so that's why I think that as our leaders need to be able to articulate what the interest is. We need to first of all come out with what our interest is. It will be rooted in an identity. And maybe this, if you allow me, maybe I can talk about it in a subsequent point. But the question of the state in Africa comes into the discussion as well in terms of the kind of state systems we have in the continent and how, why we need to rethink and reform some of these state systems in order to be able to become you know, more effective players in this geopolitical game that we are talking about.
Yeah, I was going to come to that, to be honest with you. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because to be able to do that, I think you, one, first need to look at the structure of the state in Africa. I want us to look at, because many people that I've brought up here, and even my own study, I've always held the state to be one of the greatest enemy of Africa. So when I say the state, a lot of people talk about elite capture, elitism. The problem of Africa is elitism. The problem of Africa is the state structure. And in the book that I'm writing at the moment, I'm looking at how the adopted system, political system, whether it's liberal democracy, but it's called elections, are this is like, if I use the word inimical to are they also contributing to the militarization of leading to the lack of prosperity that we're seeing? So if you're talking about that, because I was going to say, who is going to drive this? Is it the state, the same state that we see to be not neutral, to be, you know, who is going to drive this? How do we change that state? How do we achieve that part? So I wanted to see if you have, you know, some advice regarding to that. Because one thing I've seen, so can you hear me?
I can't. I'm not hearing you at all. It's your line is really, really.
How do we? So in Africa, a lot of people, and even myself in my research, I've held the state to be biased, and that the state in Africa is not a neutral player. The state itself is one that is not fit for the advancement of Africa. So how do we deal with that? I think that needs to be dealt with first before we can talk about a state that has the interests of the people and that can represent the people at that international level.
Well, again, once you started asking the question, the thing started breaking again. So, I think I get a sense of what you're trying to ask. You're asking whether the state is not important in actualizing, you know, an effective foreign policy, and where does the question of the state in Africa come in? If that is your question, like I was saying, yes, indeed, it is crucial, because you remember, at independence, well, so-called independence in the 1950s and 1960s, following decolonization, a lot of states were thrust into the international system. Some of these states, people have questioned whether they were actually states that had capacity, capacity not just in terms of population and people, but also in terms of the economy, to be able to enact and engage in international politics. And so many have called them marginal states that became peripheral players, because they did not have what it took to become real players in the international system. I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I can. I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. So, but besides the marginality of these states in international politics, there is the question of the way these states were formed, and that set them up for failure from the very beginning. Whether that is deliberate will be another subject of discussion. But the point is that the states in Africa and much of the developed the developing world, and we have even seen, if you really look at it, even the so-called developed world that is liberalized, where the state is said to be shrinking, you'll find that when there is a crisis, the states does not shrink. The state becomes a role player. It becomes a mode of organization, a platform for rescuing even the so-called privatized economy. We've seen this during COVID in the US. We've seen this during the economic crisis that the US had, where governments, the government of the United States had to bail out, okay, provide huge sums of money, public funds, to bail out private business. Now, this is where people will say, well, that is typical of a democratic a party and its manifesto. But we also saw a Republican government under Trump do the same bailouts for states in terms of incentives that they give, which part of the Reaganomics, you will say. But also, even during COVID, we saw Trump give out bailouts to private businesses in the US. And these two positions are against the idea of a small state, a shrinking state, a liberal state that is supposed to be run completely by business. The point I'm trying to make is that even in the developed world, the state is significant. The state is a mode of organization. So this is even more so in the developing world, like you have in Africa, where the capacity of civil society, the capacity of the private sphere of business, you know, to develop a country, to develop an economy fully, is still very limited, and a lot of people rely on government for basic provision of basic services, provision of infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. So then the question is, what is the makeup of the state in Africa, and whether the state in Africa is strong enough to be able to become an effective player in the Committee of Nations, in the international system. And so if you look at the makeup, you'll find that from inception, states in Africa were never established to be developmental. They were platforms for exploitation. They were conduits for facilitating the extraction of African resources and their transfer, and of course, mm-hmm. the wealth of Africa to Europe, right? And so what you find is that that also produced a notion of governance that was parasitic, that was not meant to serve the interests of the people. So it also then created a disconnect between what PPAK will call the two publics in Africa, in Nigeria then, but this can be broadly applied to Africa, the civic and the primordial public, and majority of the people of Africa in the primordial, and they start disconnection between them and the civic public, the civic state, the civic public, where the state, falls under. And that's why you find that most Africans see themselves first as members of their ethnic or kinship or their tribal groups or clans, as the case may be, before they identify as members of their countries. And you see this affects nation building in many ways. We have even talked about, I'm writing a paper now with a professor in Nigeria, Professor Aloysius Michael Aloysius Okoli, on the religious and ethno-regional drivers of Nigeria's foreign policy, how ethnicity informs and drives Nigeria's foreign policy. And you can find this also in different African countries where ethnicity and religion becomes the basis of how a state behaves, rather than a national interest that is rooted in nation building or rooted in the economic interests of the country. So you'll find that states where the people feel disconnected, people do not see government as theirs, do not see the state as theirs, they become removed. Then the foreign policy of that state becomes a product of the elites, the ruling elites of that country. And the ruling elites at a particular point in time would then govern that country based on their idiosyncrasies, right? And so, for instance, if you use Nigeria again as example, if you have a Muslim president at any point in time, his or her religion would determine the foreign policy position that Nigeria would take on an issue such as the Israel-Palestine conflict. If you have a Christian, the approach would be different. But all of these is supposed to be based on what will serve the interests of the country best. But oftentimes you'll find that the interest of the country is shady, is abstract, and often defined at any particular point in time by whoever is occupying the seat of office. Okay, and that makes it very dangerous. So the point I'm trying to make is that African states, or what we call states in Africa, because there is really no African state. States in Africa were designed to be parasitic, and as a result, they've produced governance problems that weaken these states and make them weak players in the international system. And until that question, the national question in each of the African countries are resolved, and this goes to the question of citizenship, unequal citizenship, you'll find that ethnicities, major ethnic groups, religious groups dominate each of these states, and it leads to conflict within these states themselves. And so there are inequality in terms of how citizens of even the same states are treated. And you can look at the Cameroonian case between French and English-speaking Cameroonians, the English-speaking are calling themselves Abasidonians and wanting to secede from the overall Cameroonian state because they have documented a litany of inequality, citizenship inequality that they face in that country. You can also talk about in Nigeria, where some groups of nations see themselves as more Nigerian than others, and ill treats what they refer to as minorities, for example. Even among the so-called top three, there are gradations on who's first and who's second and who's third, if there is a third at all. So these issues, whether you like them or not, these internal issues affect foreign policy. And until these questions are addressed, by these individual states, they will not be able to remove them from their impact from, affecting how state relations are conducted. So that's why I'm saying that the state is very important. And so, for example, you may ask, how much money states in Africa put into defense? How much of their budget goes into defense compared to education, compared to public health, for example? Most states, imagine a country like Nigeria, does not have an effective public health system. okay? It runs what is called a out of pocket model of providing public health, where what you're able to provide for public health is dependent on your pocket as an individual. So the rich get good access to public health, but even then, the rich engage in what we call medical tourism, where many of them, including those in government, fly out for medical checkups, right? Instead of providing, using the resources for medical tourism, using those resources to build systems, health systems that can take care of they themselves and their children. Some of them don't even understand the security implication of getting treated abroad. They don't understand these things because their understanding of governance is not rooted in the essence of why a state exists in the first place. So all of these things affect foreign policy. So if you want to fix foreign policy, you must start from fixing your domestic policy, your state, okay, on fixing the national question, getting citizens to rally around a common cause and defining what a common national interest is based on an agreement and understanding of what the nation needs. And once that is the case, it will become easier, okay, for you to have to articulate a common position at the supranational level in the African Union or in ECOWAS or the SADC. You know, so that would mean, if we were to do that, that would mean that some states will have no business actually even having an army. Because the question is, what do you need an army for if you have not fought any major war since 1960? A case like Botswana, okay? A case like Malawi, Togo, you know, what do these countries need an army for? Imagine if the monies that went into defense were budgeted into public health, were budgeted into a basic education. You'll have a much more educated citizenry that will be able to innovate and create wealth, and the country will be richer and become more powerful in the long term. This is what Japan did after the end of the Second World War. They demilitarized, like I heard you say something about demilitarization. Mm-hmm. It is an approach that we should to actively take, but we can't take that approach when we do not even understand what the purpose of the state is and the kind of governance that would require to redefine the purpose of the state and repurpose its essence. So once we do that, it will then become easier for us to articulate this new interest with a larger African Union interest, which will make it easier for us to say, why do we even have these states? Why don't we have a confederal government system in Africa where we cede certain powers to a government at the African Union level, where we can have a United States of Africa? You see, the leaders will become less resistant, you know, to that idea of a United States of Africa. That makes it even easier. So there's something I've written about called group hegemony in Africa. I've called for group hegemony in Africa, where group leaders, hegemonic leadership, group hegemonic leadership, where sub-regional leaders in the continent can converge, and this can be rotated, but can converge and then use that platform as a way of engaging, articulating Africa's interests and aggregating and then engaging with the rest of the world based on those articulated interests on behalf of everyone else, rather than allowing 55 countries to each deal with China, Russia, Israel, as the case may be.
Lester, you've given a very you have a deep understanding of this situation. You know, there's this statement that says a country's foreign policy is as strong as its domestic policy, something like that.
Exactly.
And you've also talked about why do we need an army, and that's the comes back to our adoption of this imported system, where liberal democracy say an army, a state must have an army. I remember, is this Senegal or Gambia? Senegal was, Gambia didn't have an army, I believe, at one point. It was Senegal before they had an issue. It's all of these things you've mentioned are the things that I'm also working on. But you've given extensive. Let me ask the last question, because I'm aware you have to go now. Moving forward, and with the way the Israel-Hamas war is going, and the way the whole, even the allies are finding it difficult now to continue to defend Israel, where does it put those African countries that are supporting Israel? And moving forward, how do you think Africa should, what position do you think it should maintain? How does it think it should, you know, interact or relate with the warring parties?
Okay. So for me, when this war broke out on the 7th, it was when Israel started the bombardment, just 3 days after the bombardment, I started talking about, a fundamental misunderstanding or the fundamental of this conflict, okay? The fundamental being the human question. That if we are to look at the conflict from an ontological point of view, human point of view, it will be very easy to resolve the conflict. And that means that if we consider humans as the same everywhere, whether they be white or that they be black, then it would mean that the killing of 1,200 plus Israelis in Israel by Hamas, we will condemn and condemn harshly. And in the same vein, we would also condemn the killing of 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza. That somehow we neglected to talk about 5,000, 6,000, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000, 25,000, now 30,000 plus Palestinians killed in by Israelis in Palestine, in Gaza, and around that area. That somehow some countries are still talking about the 1,200 people that died as a justification for the over 30,000 people that died, means that person's understanding of humans is that some humans are superior to others. Okay? So that is why you can say it's okay for 30,000 people to die because 1,200 people were killed. What you are saying in essence is that the lives of 1,200 people is so precious, much more precious than those of 30,000 plus people. Okay? Even if you are to take a conservative estimate and say half of whatever numbers the UN, the United Nations, and the Palestinian Authority are churning out as the numbers, let's take half, 15,000. 15,000 people have died, and more than 70% of them are women and children. Why is the life of the people of Israel more valuable than those 15,000 people if we were to take that number? The only reason for that is that somehow the international system was built around racial inequality between two zones of humans, the human and the non-human. The humans being the Europeans, okay, who have rights of an international system, the benefits that come from, coming together to form an international system, as opposed to the non-humans, who are supposed to be, marginal players, less of humans, who, when they, for example, are in conflict, it's understood that, well, they are barbarians, they are not humans, so we'll give them, we'll donate one or two things to support them. As against when the humans, so-called humans, are fighting in Ukraine and the entire world is supposed to pause and pay attention because, well, human beings are not fighting. Because 2 weeks before the war in Ukraine, for example, there was a war in Ethiopia, a civil war where people were dying, human beings were dying. But the world did not care. Nobody talked about it. The minute the war in Ukraine started, it was everything stopped. Everything stopped to focus on that. Why? It's again a misconception of how humans are categorized. So I've said from then that the only solution to this problem is for the world, the United Nations Security Council, the Western world, the Eastern world, everybody in the world, to start viewing humans from one ontological lens as human beings that have the same rights. And if that is correct, it will be very easy for any continent of the world, including Africa, to take a position to say, from a human point of view, this conflict is unfair on the majority of people that have been killed, and the violence must stop forthwith immediately. This was what I was saying as far back as 23rd October, and the position has not changed. Now the world is coming to the party in terms of agreeing that, well, now it's too much. But it didn't need to even get to 10,000 before the world got to this position. This morning, I heard that the Israelis are beginning to now have serious talks in Cairo about a ceasefire, because they have seen that they've lost the soft power, they've lost support of different countries of the world. And it's part of the complexity of support you see in the continent, the disconnection between government and people's support or lack of support thereof for Israel or for Palestine, as the case may be. So to answer your question more directly in a short sentence, Africa should take a principled position of saying everybody is a human being, irrespective of your color, irrespective of your race, irrespective of your gender, and that based on that, we'll craft a solution that validates humans. It means that naturally we'll be going for a two-state solution and the rebuilding of Gaza and the protection, a guarantee, not for Israel, as Israel has always articulated, as the West have always articulated, but guarantee of peace and security for the people of Gaza who have been suffering oppression, whose humanity has not been validated, not just by Israel, but the rest of the world. This is a collective wound on our conscience as humans, unless we have accepted that some human beings are more human than others. So Africa's position should be based on the principle of humanity and pursue that consistently, as South Africa has done. And I think that this is what the rest of the continent should be doing, irrespective of what economics they would get from that position or lose from that position.
I agree with you 100%. I think it was Mamdine, I know you know him, the scholar Mamdine, that was talking about, when he's talking about colonial Africa, talking about how they were able to get away with it. They had the European had they called them as citizens, and then the others were like subjects. So subjects didn't have rights to civil protection.
That's Mahmoud Mamdani.
Mahmoud Mamdani, yeah. So that's that concept. I agree with that 100%. Listen, I'm so grateful to have you today. I like how you talked about the state in Africa. Now that state in Africa is more like an impediment to Africa's growth and all of that. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your great insight. And we'll keep you posted when this is, would employ you to help us share it among your network. And hopefully we're able to bring you back again to talk, see the next phase, what's going to happen if, you know, the world will come to its senses and deal with these issues. And I'll let you go to your meeting, but really, we're really grateful for your time. Grateful to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and all the best with your podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for tuning in today with Professor Isike for that useful insight into Africa's position on the Israel-Hamas war. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. I implore you to stay tuned, subscribe, like, and share, and stay tuned for another explosive and exciting episode next week. For now, take care, and I'll see you.